What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I speak with Robert Kerbick. Robert Kerbick is an author and former corporate spy. His newest memoir, Ruse, Lying the American Dream from Hollywood to Wall Street, is a thrilling look into the world of corporate espionage and his career as a secret spy. Robert's essays and short stories have been featured in numerous magazines and literary journals. One story was adapted into the award-winning film Reconnected. A lifetime member of the Actors Studio, Robert has worked extensively in theater, film, and television, which we certainly get into. He's also appeared in lead roles in major shows and earned several awards. Additionally, Robert has fought one of the worst fires in California history, the 2018 Woolsey Fire, to save his home. His debut book, Malibu Burning, The Real Story Behind LA's Most Devastating Wildfire, has won several awards and was also a silver medalist in nonfiction drama at the Reader's Favorite Awards. And now I give you Robert Kerbick.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Robert Kerbick. Robert, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm excited to speak with you. I want to discuss, obviously, let's call it espionage. I want to discuss your book, Ruse. I want to discuss your career in general, your various brushes with history, which we talked a little bit about before I hit record here. Before we do, Robert, please tell listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Yeah. So, you know, the reason I'm here is because I was an actor back in the day. Actors need survival jobs. Who stumbles into a career as a corporate spy? But that's what happened to me. And my survival job that started out in the beginning, I was getting $8 an hour to spy on the largest corporations in the world, eventually, you know, morphed into me making $2 million a year. And I earned the reputation as the world's greatest corporate spy.
Awesome. Thank you, Robert. I can already tell you piqued our listeners' interest. And we'll be planning on tracking through a bit of that as we go along, obviously. I actually wouldn't mind, Robert, starting slightly out of context, an interesting point in contact for both of us, which we also talked about. I know you're more than familiar with my former interviewee, Valerie Plame, who I know you went to high school with. I'd love to ask you, just to kick us off out of context, what your relationship with her has been like.
Oh, well, you know, I love this conversation because Valerie's a rock star. I think she's an American hero. And of course, what are the odds that two spies went to the same small Philadelphia area high school? Makes you wonder, were they teaching, like, you know, surveillance 101, you know, instead of woodshop? But yeah, Valerie and I, not only did we go to high school together, we went to middle school together, and we even went to elementary school together. Valerie and I went to school, I think, from third grade on. It was a relatively small high school. We knew each other quite well. We had numerous classes together. I danced with her at the eighth grade dance. So you can imagine, here I am, a corporate spy, and when Valerie gets outed by the Bush administration, you can imagine what I'm thinking. First of all, I'm blown away because I had no idea Valerie was a spy, as no one did. But then I'm a spy, you know, so it's just blowing my mind that this person that I knew so well was, doing something similar to what I was doing. Now, of course, Valerie was doing it for good. I was doing it for different reasons that were less altruistic. And of course, in my book, Ruse, I talk a lot about that. And I deal with a lot of the ethical issues because, here I was stealing secrets from major corporations for financial remuneration, whereas Valerie was trying to do things to make the United States of America a safer place. And I love Valerie. Valerie actually has done a number of events with me. She's been incredibly generous. We've done a couple of events, kind of spies come in from the cold. It was one of the headlines. And we talk about the differences between political spying and corporate spying and the similarities. And she's now invited me to come and speak. Her current husband is the president of a university in New Mexico, and I'm going to be the featured speaker there in November. And then it's followed up. She has this really critically important conference called Spies, Lies, and Nukes about nuclear proliferation and disarmament, which obviously right now with the situation in Russia and Ukraine is even more important. And so she's invited me to that conference. So it's really going to be exciting for me because this corporate spy, I'm going to be, hanging out with like the KGB spies and the CIA spies, so I'm going to finally hit the big leagues.
There you go. Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Real life truly is stranger than fiction. So I'd love to ask you, Robert, what was it that made you want to pursue acting?
Great question. So, I grew up in Philadelphia and my great grandfather sold horse carriages before cars were invented. He saw the writing on the wall, switched to automobiles, became one of the first automobile dealers in Philadelphia. My grandfather took over that dealership. My father took over that dealership, and I was supposed to take that over that dealership. I was the oldest son. And when I graduated college, I went to work for my dad, and it just didn't feel right to me. The trickery of car sales, something just didn't sit right with me, which of course turned out to be pretty ironic when I go and get a job as a corporate spy, which ended up being far more ethically challenging than car sales. So I moved to New York. And again, as I said, actors need survival jobs. A buddy of mine had this job. He was very mysterious about it. He wouldn't tell me about it. And I basically begged him. I said, dude, I'm broke. I need a job. And so he got me an interview with this woman. She lived on the Upper East Side. Your listeners may not know, but the Upper East Side is kind of like the real old money area of Manhattan. And sure enough, she lives in a doorman building, gorgeous building. She lives in the penthouse. I take the elevator up. She ushers me into the nicest apartment I've ever been into. And right away, I knew whatever she did, it was lucrative. And it turns out that she is running this small, secretive spy firm that only hires actors because she needs people that can do accents, voices, create characters to trick people inside major corporations into releasing secret and private information and then selling that information to that company's main rival.
Incredible. Thank you for running through that. You mentioned this to Jordan Harbinger, who I've also interviewed. I don't mean to keep signaling my former interviewees, but I'd love to talk a little bit about that, about social engineering, perhaps for our listeners, what is that? And then you also discussed, I think, an interesting dynamic between how men would traffic in that job versus how women would traffic in that job. In fact, if I have you quoted correctly, you had said that the firm only hired women. Do I have that correct?
Yeah. In the beginning, the woman who hired me, my buddy was the first guy she had ever hired, and then I was the second, and then she never hired another guy again. She only hired women. And it's funny, you use the term social engineering. I call it rusing, hence the title of my book, Ruse. So, I think in the beginning, we would go in person to corporations, to conferences, to bars, to restaurants, to sporting events, where we knew certain firms were, and we would try to, ruse people into releasing information. They'd had some drinks, whatever. And, we got some information doing that. But what we quickly learned was that we could actually use the, good old fashioned phone call, what we call the ruse call, to get people to release far more information over the phone than they would in person. So we would use the anonymity of the phone call because in the phone call, we could say we were anyone. We could say we were in any office. Yeah, this is Gerhard calling from the office in Frankfurt, Germany. We have the European Union regulators here. We need some information from the States. Oh, hey, Gerhard, buddy. Whoa, what's going on, right? What's the reaction? People are surprised. Like, you're smiling. You hear that accent. You're laughing. people are like, and of course, I'm pretending I'm a real guy. There really is a Gerhard in the office. He runs compliance. He runs legal for Europe. So they kind of know this guy's name. Probably haven't spoken to him, but they can look him up on their system. Oh, whoa, this is so weird. You're calling me. I don't know why you're calling me for this information, but what are people taught in the world of corporations? Be a good teammate, right? You know, have a positive culture, you know, help each other out. So is the person, when Gerhard calls and starts asking kind of strange questions, is the person going to say nine? No, they never said nine to Gerhard. They said, hey, Gerhard, buddy, you're jammed up. What do you need? How can I help you? They would tell me stuff that made no sense for them to tell me. They would find, if they didn't know it, they would go, hey, Gerhard, let me put you on hold. My buddy Tommy will know the answer to that. Let me call him for you real fast, right? They'd give me their passwords. Whatever it was that my clients wanted to know, I could find out by portraying myself as someone internal within the firm. And then, of course, we would also imitate the accents of, you know, obviously the Gerhard's an obvious example with the German accent, but we would call and we would listen to someone's voicemail, you know, so we'd call and we'd get an executive. We'd call after hours on person and you go, yeah, this is Rick Jones in tax. I'm not here. Leave a message. And I'd go, well, I can imitate that voice. So then the next day I'd call someone up and I'd go, hey, it's Rick Jones. And oh, hey, Rick, how are you? And every once in a while, if somebody, hey, Rick, you sound a little funny today. Oh, I've got a terrible cold. If I cough or sneeze in your ear, don't hold it against me. Oh, okay. That's why you sound a little off, right? But if somebody believes you are a real senior executive within a firm, what are they not going to tell you? And I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but, you know, we're living in this scary time of AI, right?
Where, yes.
You know, now you don't have to be a trained actor to do accents, right? You can literally have AI calling and sounding like your brother, your mother, your boss, you know, your best friend, whomever. So that, you know, if you think the person on the other end of the line really is who they say they are, what are you not going to tell them? Of course, hey, you need my credit card number? My brother's broken down by the side of the road? Sure. You know, sure. Here it is. Right. And, you know, and I do these videos, which I post on Tuesdays, which I call Ruse Day, designed to help people. And one of the things I say is crazy as this sounds, but families need to have a secret code word. And they need to have a code word so that if they get a strange call from a family member, you're going to say, what's the code word? And AI is not going to know the code word.
That is fascinating, Robert. I really appreciate you running through that. And that makes sense to me about the code word. Sounds maybe slightly paranoid, but hey, in the world of AI, I'm not sure it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, today maybe it's paranoid. In 2 months, everybody in America will be doing it, right? That's how fast this thing could change.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sort of listening to our imagined audience in my head right now. I'm certain they would want me to ask you about the ethics / morality / legality of doing what you did. And first off, it's my fault. I should have asked you earlier. What years did you operate doing this?
So I started, you know, kind of around late 80s, early 90s, and then went up through the crash of 2008, the Great Recession. And then that was when I basically decided I had to extricate myself from this business. And in the book, in Ruse, I deal a lot with the moral issues. I don't make any excuses. You know, I do throw out what my rationalizations were at the time. And one of them was, you know, we started out, the firms we were targeting in the beginning were mainly Wall Street firms. We were in New York. The woman's firm was really going after the big banks. And it was kind of like, you know, well, boo-hoo for Goldman Sachs if I steal some secrets from you. Like, is anybody going to really feel sorry for Goldman Sachs? I mean, I can make a pretty good argument that it was the greed of Wall Street that caused the crash of 2008 and wreaked tremendous havoc on individuals across the world. So I didn't feel sorry for the banks. And then, of course, later we were getting secrets from the major tech firms, pharmaceutical firms, industrial firms. But that still doesn't make it right, because even though they were corporations, the people that I was tricking, that I was rusing, were individuals, right? And I do feel regret for that. And in the book, I acknowledge that. And in terms of the legality, you know, when we first started doing this job, again, in the beginning, we were getting $8 an hour, which is, seems hilarious now, because one of our first jobs was we were penetrating defense firms and we were getting secrets from individuals that, you know, had top secret clearance, and we were getting secrets that if we'd been selling them to the Russians and the Chinese, could have put us in jail for the rest of our lives. But we were just selling those secrets to that firm's top rivals. You know what I mean? And so somehow that was sort of okay. But we met with an attorney, and the attorney, or I'll never forget it, the attorney said, he had a very, very serious look on his face, and he said, "What you're doing is in the gray, the very dark gray." And it was only because no corporate spy, it was so new, this corporate spying thing, that there was no basically case law around it. And so he was like, "Look, I can't tell you, but I can tell you that if somebody comes after you, it's not going to be good." And later, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody that wants to buy the book or listen to it because it's on Audible, but at one point we were being hunted by every three-letter agency in the world for our activities.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, that it reminds me of that show Succession. Greg's on the phone and he says, "Well, the lawyer said it's basically legal, but he didn't want to put that into an email."
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. What does that tell you, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So a kind of through line I'm thinking about, Robert, as we're going along here is salesmanship, obviously an aptitude for sales. You know, obviously, you started as an actor. You already mentioned you kind of come from a family of salespeople. I'd love to know how those skills overlapped with being a spy, right? I mean, was it just simply sales skills coming into play on the phone?
Well, that's a great question. And I think if any of your listeners are looking to pivot to a new career, like many people are in America today, I'm here to tell you that the world of corporate spying is lucrative and corporations are desperate for spies. So if anybody wants to reach out to me after the program, I'm easy to find. I'm happy to give you some tips on how to get into corporate spying. You know, one of the things that was the most shocking, the number one most shocking thing to me after I wrote this book, Ruse, I out myself as a corporate spy in the book. I cannot tell you how many corporations reached out to me and said, "Robert, we want to hire you to spy for us." And I said, "You do realize that I've written an expose about corporate spying. I've identified myself to the world as a corporate spy, and now you want me to go back in and spy for you?" And they said, "Yes, please." So, you know, I think, you know, so yes, salesmanship is one of the important things. My family, because they were car dealers, not just car salespeople, there was an entrepreneurial quality. I think also because my background, you know, I'm part Armenian, I'm part Jewish, and ancestors on both of those sides barely escaped with their lives. Armenians barely escaped being massacred by the Turks, my Jewish relatives obviously by the Germans. And so I think in my DNA, there's this instinct for survival, a kind of like, you got to do what you got to do to survive. And again, that's not to justify, you know, what I did, but that was some of the thinking as a young guy. And of course, in the beginning, I'm going, "Look, I'm getting $8 an hour. It's just a job to pay the bills. You know, I'm going to be a famous actor." And I was a working actor. You know, I did 50 major TV shows, lead roles, you know, worked with George Clooney, yep, Kevin Spacey, Paul Newman, you know, on and on and on. And I think that the combination of the skills, you know, sales, entrepreneurship, and then acting, which teaches you a lot of people think, you know, of course, actors have the gift of gab. But I think for good actors, the most important quality is to be a really great listener. Mm. And in my phone calls, I could hear in your silence on the line what you were thinking. I could hear in the silence whether you were going to give me the information or not. And so when I would hear that silence on the line, most times I knew something was off, and then I would immediately try to do something to satisfy that objection, which had not even been voiced yet. And that's something that a really good salesperson can do, is they can read the body language, they can read the voice in a way that enables them to determine what's going on in the mind of the potential customer so they can try to satisfy that before it's too late. Because usually in a deal situation, once someone has decided no, it's very difficult to turn them around. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. So you want to try to not ever have them say no first.
Yeah, I understand that. I was in sales myself for 12 years, something like that. And it is that idea of the psychology of if they say no once, they're going to say it again and again and again. And you want to get them to say, yes, you know, if you're drowning, should I throw you a life raft? Yes. Okay, great. And then you move on to whatever's next. Let me see. Thank you, Robert. I appreciate that. We may have skipped past this. I may have asked it earlier, but I think it may have blown past a little bit. In the recruitment training, I'd love for you to discuss a little bit about how women trafficked through the job versus how you and your friend did.
Oh, in the corporate spy. Yes.
Yes, sir.
You know, in the beginning, the woman who hired us only hired women because she felt that women made better spies. And when I was doing an event with Valerie Plame, Valerie said, of course, women make better spies. And we laughed. And I said, well, why is that? You know, explain that to me. And she said, because women are able to reflect and deflect better than men. They don't get their egos involved. They don't get their backup. They could be more chameleon-like. And it made a lot of sense to me, you know. And I think in the beginning, when I was doing the corporate spying, my buddy who got me the job, Pax, the women were better than we were. That we were really struggling. You know, they would call up and they would use these ploys, because we had all these ploys that we developed. And one of their ploys was, as unbelievable as it sounds, and it's funny, what I learned in this job is the more outlandish the ruse, in a strange way, the more believable it was. And so these women would cry on the phone. They would call, they remember they're trained actors, and they would call up and they'd call another assistant and they'd pretend to be an assistant and they'd say, my boss is horrible. My boss is terrible. He's such an ass. I lost this paper. I lost this document. I can't find this document. And, I'm going to lose my job. I've got two kids. And then they'd be crying on the phone. And to my shock, because they trained me, the assistant on the other end of the line would go, oh, calm down. It's okay. My boss is an asshole too. What did you lose? Let me help you. And then they would give them the, and I couldn't believe it. Well, of course, as a dude, you know, yeah. it's going to be a lot hard for me to go, it just wasn't going to work.
Right.
So the ploys that they use, kind of going assistant to assistant, and remember back in the day, the 90s, early 2000s, most of the assistants were still female. I'm imagining now that's changed significantly. So they had an advantage. So we were like, we can't use that ploy. You know, what ploy are we going to use? And so eventually, as we gained confidence, we would go bro to bro, you know, and I would call an executive as another executive. And that was another way I rationalized the job, is now I wasn't calling an assistant that was making, you know, $15 an hour. I was calling executives, bros, that were making millions of dollars a year. So I didn't have, you know, a lot of empathy for them, because I'm like, look, you're making millions of dollars a year. If I trick you, I ruse you, and you give me this information, that's your bad, not mine, you know? And so I would go bro to bro. Hey, it's Rick in the LA office. What's going on, Tom? Hey, Rick, what's going on? Oh, yeah, I got to get out there. Oh, I'll take you out for a drink. Oh, what's going on? What do you need? And then we're bros, we're friends. And now he'd give me whatever information that I was trying to get.
It's incredible.
And remember, we didn't talk about what kind of information, but, you know, think about, I'm a big football fan. We talked a little bit about football earlier. Think about if you could get the playbook on your opponent couple days before the big game, right? How valuable would that be? And that's what the clients who hired me wanted. They wanted the playbook on their rival. Were they hiring people? Were they firing people? What did they pay their people? Who were the rock stars? Who were the top people at their company? What their new products were? What were they going to charge for the new products? You know, who were their clients? What were the client contracts? How much were the client contracts worth? When were they expiring? Like, all of that information, if you find that out, and we did, that could take your company, let's say you were number 7 in a space, you ranked number 7, it could take you to number 1, number 2. How much money is that worth? Forget about millions of dollars. Forget about tens of millions of dollars. That information was worth hundreds of millions, potentially billions of dollars.
Incredible. I'd love to ask you, Robert, the question is going to sound kind of crude. I don't mean for it to be, but I'd love to hear an awesome story of getting these secrets. Is there one that particularly stands out for you?
You know, there's so many. You know, one that I think is kind of funny. So back in the day, right before the crash of 2008, so, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006, the economy is just humming. And, you know, you may remember that was the year that, you know, your unemployed brother-in-law was buying 6 houses in Florida. And you're like, how the hell is he buying 6? You know, it was just free money and everybody was, you know, go, go, go and spend, spend, spend. And you could get a loan and all of this stuff. And Wall Street, of course, was booming. And there was this one trading team on Wall Street, which had done the biggest trade in Wall Street history. They were at Morgan Stanley, I think an 8-person team, and they had done this trade and they had made Morgan Stanley, and I'm just going to pick a number off the top of my head. I think they made Morgan Stanley $1 billion in this trade, one trade. So my client, who was, of course, Morgan Stanley's big rival, said, we want to know the 8 people on this team. Now, some of your listeners may think, well, that's not, how hard can that be? Well, remember, this is pre-LinkedIn, and firms guard these valued employees. Many times, they're not even listed in the corporate directory. Steve Jobs, legendary CEO of Apple, would not allow the Apple designers to be in the Apple corporate directory because he knew if somebody stole one of the designers of the iPad in the early days of the iPad, how devastating that could be for Apple. And by the way, Apple is easily the most successful company in terms of protecting secrets in the world, right? And most companies are, I mean, nothing like Apple. So I'm tasked with finding this 8-person team. And I find this 8-person team, and my client recruits 2 of those people away. And then those 2 people do a trade that I think was worth like $3 billion. So you say, well, how much was it worth for me to find that information out? And then, you know, some portion of $1 billion, right? And again, you think about it. If you poached one of the designers of the iPad in the early days of the iPad, billions of dollars.
All day long.
And that's the thing. Yeah, that's the thing about this corporate spying. And that's why it's still lucrative. That's why there's such a demand. That's why I write the book. I out myself and people are still begging me to spy. Because this information, even with LinkedIn, it's just a game changer. You know, it's just a game changer. And, you know, corporations, you know, these executives make millions and they are as competitive as LeBron James and Tom Brady. You know, their bonuses are tied to the stock price, the revenue of their company. So if their company makes more money, they make more money. If their company doesn't make more money, they lose their job. So they are incentivized to cut corners and find out secrets so that their companies can excel.
Yeah. To quote Gordon Gekko, the most valuable commodity he knows of is information, right?
Yeah, right. That's right.
I appreciate that, Robert. And you set me up with a nice, easy transition here. I'd love to talk about your run-up to the infamous, of course, 2008 crash, you know, spying all these firms. I'd love to know how you brushed with history in that sense.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, a lot of this stuff is in the movie The Big Short, right? So there's this crazy thing going on where, you know, I'm being asked to research these mortgage-backed derivatives areas. And I get an assignment to find out people that are doing this. And then like a month later, I get another assignment from a different client to research the same areas. And then a month after that, I get another assignment from another client to research it. And I'm going, what is going on? Why does everybody want to know about these mortgage-backed securities and these mortgage-backed derivatives and insurance on the derivatives and all of this complicated, you know, Wall Street, you know, mumbo jumbo? And I began to realize, and of course, housing prices are going up, up, up. And you're starting to see, you know, I live in Malibu. It's a well-to-do area. And I was looking at these houses. I'm like, who can afford these houses? Nobody can afford these houses. I was a corporate spy making millions of dollars a year. I couldn't afford those houses. So I knew something was wrong. Something wasn't right. And I began to realize that everyone was over-leveraged. Everyone was over-leveraged in a way that was dangerous. And so in some way, I wasn't the first person to see the crash coming. But I will say I was definitely the first actor to see the crash coming. But I knew the crash was coming. I knew it was unsustainable. And so that was kind of one of the crazy things is I was in this moment in time where I could see, you know, the financial devastation that was about to hit the country.
Yeah, could see the tidal wave coming. It's interesting. It's fascinating. Yeah, and of course now, you know, we certainly don't live in a world, I don't know, but perhaps you do, I don't, where we can buy 6 houses at one time.
Yeah, no. You know, and that's funny. That's one, I got to throw this out because, you know, one of the things about Malibu is everybody thinks that everyone that lives here is rich or famous. And I'm here to tell you that's not the case. Now, maybe if you live on the ocean side of the Pacific Coast Highway, yes. But if you live on the land side of the Pacific Coast Highway, up in the nooks and crannies and the hills and the mountains of Malibu, it's very different. That's where I live. If I hadn't bought my house in 2000, I never would have been able to afford my house today. So I'm just very lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you, Robert. I appreciate that. I want to ask about O.J. Simpson shortly because I know you have some interesting experiences there. But I think it's high time I ask you, what was it that prompted you to write the book Ruse?
Well, I actually started Ruse first, and then we had this terrible wildfire in Malibu in 2018, which your audience, I'm sure, remembers, the Malibu fires. And, you know, a significant portion of Malibu burned to the ground. On my street, 17 of 19 houses burned to the ground. In my neighborhood, over 200 of 270 homes burned to the ground. And my family fought the fire, and we saved our home. It was a hair-raising experience. Our lives were in jeopardy. The LA Times asked me to write an essay about that experience, which I did. And then a publisher reached out and asked me to write a book about the Malibu fires. And so I put Ruse on the back burner, pun intended. And because obviously the fires were very time sensitive, right? You know, because, you know, people might not be very interested if the book took 5 years to come out. And I wanted the book to come out within a year. And I did. The book came out on the anniversary of the fire 1 year later. And it was basically the story of this community that a lot of people think that they know, but they really don't know. A lot of the history of Malibu, which I didn't know before I wrote the book, which is fascinating. I mean, Malibu up until the 1950s was owned by one woman, all of Malibu, every single, you know, Rancho Malibu. And there were gates preventing people from getting into Malibu, and just a fascinating story. And so then after Malibu Burning came out, I went back to Ruse and I finished Ruse. And then Ruse ended up being my second book, even though I had started working on it before. And I said, forgive me, that the first book is Malibu Burning. And after Malibu Burning came out and did really well, then a publisher asked me, hey, what else you got? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I got this other book. It's almost done. And they said, great.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thanks, Robert. Yeah, I would like to ask you about your experiences working with O.J. Simpson. My understanding is this has something to do with an exercise video.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I was an actor. I was a working actor. And, you know, working actors can't be too picky about jobs. And so one day my manager called me up and he said, hey, there's an exercise video. They're looking to hire some guys. And I said, no. I can't dance. I'm the worst dancer in the history of mankind. And no, he said, no, it's not dancing. It's an exercise video for men. It's for O.J. Simpson. And I said, O.J. Simpson. I love O.J. Simpson. You know, old enough to remember him kind of at the end of his football career. And then he was an announcer and he did movies. And, you know, in Capricorn One, he was even a pretty good actor. So I said, yeah, I'm in. And then, so I go and I show up on the set, and the set is a dance studio. And I'm introduced to someone who is the choreographer. And here I've been told that we're going to be like doing push-ups and sit-ups, maybe playing pickup basketball. And, you know, now I'm like, what, you know, and sure enough, the choreographer, there are these two beautiful women who are professional dancers, and me and OJ, and the choreographer goes through this routine with this stuff, and everybody follows it as best they can, and I'm completely lost. And the choreographer comes over, you know, he's white as a sheep, pale as a ghost, and he goes, how did you get hired for this job? Like, what are you doing here, you know? And he's literally about to fire me right on the spot, and OJ says, oh, no, you can't get rid of Rob. Rob's dancing is so bad, it's making me look good. And it was an interesting lesson, because I learned right in that moment, rule number one in Hollywood, make your star look good. And inadvertently, my bad dancing was making OJ look good. And as I found out later, he was very nervous that he was going to look bad. He was going to look awkward. And so by me being so bad and awkward, he looked good. So OJ basically stopped me from getting fired. And that started this very strange relationship on the set where he and I became buds. And at one point he pulled me aside and he said, hey, you want to see the video for this TV pilot I just shot for NBC? It's called Frogmen. I said, sure. You know, in my head, I'm going, wow, OJ's going to be doing this series. Maybe he can get me on, you know, a guest star. This is fantastic. And he shows me pops in the trailer, and he explains that his character is a knife expert. Think about that, right?
Yeah.
Truth is stranger than fiction.
Indeed.
And so it was just a very strange thing. And then later in the shoot, he started to sexually harass one of the women dancers, this very attractive blonde woman. And of course, at the time, I didn't know who Nicole Brown Simpson was. But later, I realized, you know, after the murders and Nicole Brown Simpson's face was on TV all the time, the woman that he was sexually harassing literally resembled Nicole Brown Simpson. I mean, I'm not going to say she was the spitting image, but they looked a lot alike, you know. So clearly OJ had a type. He was sexually harassing this woman. You know, I like to think that would never happen today. I pulled the woman aside. I said, hey, look, we can call the Screen Actors Guild. We can get a monitor here on set. But of course, she didn't want to get fired. And back in the day, if she had said anything, had a monitor come down, they probably would have fired her. Or if they didn't fire her, she would never have gotten another job again. She would have been blackballed, you know, all of that stuff, you know. So she said no. And she just, you know, was kind of grinning and bearing it for the rest of the shoot. But OJ's behavior was reprehensible and offensive and quite disturbing. Now, of course, in the moment, I didn't know the history that was about to happen.
Of course.
No, I didn't know what was going to happen. But in retrospect, people say, did you see the signs? Yeah. Clear as day. Clear as day.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, what the landscape looked like pre-Me Too, you know, pre-Harvey Weinstein, post-Harvey Weinstein, I should say. Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Robert. I'd love to pivot a little bit, talk about something that means a great deal to me, and I know to you as well, which is the craft of writing. I'd like to ask you, Robert, what does writing mean to you?
It's just a way to express myself, and I love telling stories, you know, and to be able to, you know, tell a story with words and create characters and make it fun. I like to write with humor. You know, that to me, that's just, it's just such a great pleasure, you know, and I like to write stuff that is easy to read. And when I, you know, sometimes, you know, I have a lot of friends that are really great writers and smart writers, and their books are hard to read sometimes, you know, and I don't, I'm not putting that down at all, but I like to write a page turner. So, you know, Ruse, even though it's nonfiction and it's true, it reads like a spy novel, right? When you're reading a spy novel, you're like, okay, what happened next? What happened next? So I have a lot of fun with that.
Awesome. Yeah, and I understand what you mean about, what should we say, prose that's too wordy, feels like you're trying to penetrate it, feels more like homework than a recreational activity.
Yeah, all right. Well, I mean, I was reading this book the other day by this writer, I'm not going to give their name, and, okay. And you know, he's dropping big words in every sentence, sometimes two big words in every sentence. And, you know, look, I went to college, I'm a writer, I feel like I'm not a dumb guy, and yet I don't know most of these words. Now, I think, you know, I should know every word in a book, and I should occasionally look up a word here and there, but it was too much, and it was distracting, and it was stopping me from reading, it was stopping the storytelling, and I felt it was quite pretentious. And this writer is very successful, so what the hell do I know?
How about your evolution as a writer, Robert? Like, so for me, I'm a huge lover of George Orwell. I suspect the name Christopher Hitchens might be known to you, Salman Rushdie, among others. Do you have any particular writing inspirations that have sort of guided you as you went on?
You know, yeah, you know, because I'm an actor, I would say, you know, Tennessee Williams, William Shakespeare,
sure,
David Mamet, right? Playwrights, you know, because I came out of the theater, you know, and one of the things people have said about my writing is that my dialogue is really, you know, strong. And I would hope so, because as a former actor, you know, I should be able to write, you know, really good dialogue. So that's kind of cool. But, you know, I also was an English major in college, so I've read many, many books. And I don't know that I have a favorite author per se, the way I do with playwrights. But, you know, I've read many John Irving books, love John Irving. And I like to read a lot of different things. I think the evolution for me in writing, which is interesting, is I started off when I came back to writing after I left acting and corporate spying and circled back to writing, where I'd actually started with as an English major in college and then left it because I couldn't sit still long enough to write. But now as an older guy, I was able to sit in a chair and write. And I started writing short stories, fictional short stories. And to my surprise, I sent them out to magazines and they would get accepted. And that was what kind of made me go, wait a second now, maybe this is possible. But what's been surprising to me is here I got, you know, 20 short stories published in some really big literary journals. But my books to this date have all been nonfiction. So it's interesting how, you know, here I was writing all these, you know, fictional short stories, yet I haven't had a fictional novel published yet. I'm hoping that's going to change soon because I have a completed novel and I'm hoping that'll be, you know, my next book out in the universe.
Yeah. Fantastic, Robert. Thank you. Best of luck with that. Yeah. For me, I suppose Christopher Hitchens wrote a book on George Orwell called Why Orwell Matters, which is a wonderful sort of critique on his work, what it meant to him. In any event, yeah, since we're exchanging, you know, book recommendations, I suppose, to our listeners, I'll throw that out there.
Yeah, and speaking of George Orwell, I did a production of 1984 at the Kennedy Center. in Washington, D.C. as a young actor.
Wow. The touch points. I love it. Let me see. I just have a couple questions left, Robert. Then you're no longer my prisoner, okay?
Love it. No, this is fantastic.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. I've enjoyed speaking with you. So this might be similar to our last conversation, but I'll risk it and throw it out there anyway. So in your journey as an author, Robert, are there any sort of salient lessons you learned about storytelling, self-expression, and how you might not empathize, how you might connect with the reader?
How about don't use too many exclamation points?
Yes, the Hemingway thing.
Oh my God. I was reading a book today. It was not a bad book, but the number of exclamation points was killing me. I stopped. I put it down. I'm the type of reader. There's a lot of people. My wife, she picks up a book. She's going to finish the book no matter what. I pick up a book. If you lose me, it's on you. It's like, you got to keep the reader's interest. You know, you got to keep the reader's interest, you know, and I tell people, there are a lot of people, especially as people get older, they want to put down their story, you know, and basically write a memoir. And I think that's fantastic. And I don't think you have to have your memoir, you know, published by a traditional publisher. You can self-publish your memoir. Yep. I think it's great. I think everybody should do it. But if you're going to do it right. Have it edited, not by your wife, not by your best friend, not by your second cousin who taught third grade for 4 years part-time. Like, hire a professional editor. You know, and really do it right, because it's your life story. And once you put it out there on Amazon or wherever you self-publish it, it's going to be there forever. So you really want it to be the best possible book. And I tell people when they're writing memoirs, because I teach for the city of Malibu, and one of the things I say is, you know, think of your memoir as a greatest hits album, right? It's not every song you've ever written. It's just the greatest hits. Huh. And so many times I see a memoir and it says, you know, my first memory was when I was 2 and I did this and this. But then the summer I turned 3, Aunt Tilda died. Then when I was 4, and it's like, no. The greatest hits. And you think about a greatest hits album. How many songs are on the greatest hits record? 10, 12. So you got to pick like the 10 pivotal moments in your life and tie those together, and that's your book.
That's great advice, Robert. Thanks, man. I'd love to ask you if there's anything that you're working on currently, Robert, anything you'd like to tell our listeners about.
Well, Ruse, you know, has got a lot of interest in Hollywood. You know, the Frank Abagnale, who wrote Catch Me If You Can, which of course was turned into a great movie. He read Ruse and loved the book and was incredibly kind and generous and gave me a blurb, which is on the cover of Ruse. And when the Catch Me If You Can guy says good things about your book, people in Hollywood prick up their ears. And so Ruse is in development for a TV series. It's possible it could be a movie. I think it is would be better as a TV series, but there's some people that want it as a movie. Some people want it as a TV series. So, you know, keep your fingers crossed that Ruse is on some screen in some way, shape, or form in the near future.
Beautiful. Both my fingers crossed for you, Robert.
Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Robert Kerbick, how can people find out about you, sir?
Oh, thank you for asking. You know, I tell people, just go to my website. It's easy. It's my name, Robert Kerbick, KERBECK.com. You know, there's no filter. I'm the only one that's looking at the site. So if you email me from my site, I will respond. As I said earlier, if somebody's looking to pivot into a new career and they want to let go, well, what is this corporate spying? You know, reach out, ask me your questions. I'll guide you as best I can. And you can also see the trailer for Ruse is on my site, which gives you a sense of what the Hollywood people are thinking in terms of a filmed version, which is fun. And you can also purchase Ruse or Malibu Burning. You can read some of my short stories. There's a lot of fun stuff on there.
Beautiful, beautiful. The books, once again, are Ruse and Malibu Burning. I'd highly recommend them, listeners. Robert Kerbick, this was such a pleasure, man. I really appreciate you taking the time for me. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Josh.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.